Hi, Cynthia.
Hi.
Hi, Senator.
Yes, good morning.
I know that you're in a different part of a different subject here, but I guess I kind of wanted to add in a little bit with the last two callers and what, you know, Rick was saying and what, you know, some of these other two other individuals were discussing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a felony conviction is a double standard because, I mean, you know, person, if they're convicted of a felony, they go to jail, they get out, and they get on with their life. However, they're also branded with this felony, which not only does it prevent you from voting, but it also hinders you from, you know, being able to leave the United States. You know, it also allows people to play judge, jury, and executioner when it comes time to fill out an application. I mean, there's several different things. I mean, and, you know, and people could say, well, geez, you know, the guy's trying. But the thing of it is that, you know, when does the punishment end?
Well, you're right about that. And there's been a lot of studies that have done on that. A lot of defense attorneys have stepped up to the plate and said that when a person is released from the prison system and they're going back into the community, that should be the end of it. Their debt to society is paid. But the point that you bring up is a very good one. It's also a very controversial one, especially when you're talking about sex offenders and the sex offender registry. The sex offender registry, by some critics, says that the individual is sentenced to life. And there are a lot of people in the community that take the position of, good, so what? You've made your point. It's clear to me. I understand the point of view of a defense counsel. And it's a complicated issue. There's no easy answer for that. But certainly a felony is typically a violent crime, not always, but in many cases it's a violent crime. And states who do not allow people who are convicted of felonies to vote may be something that needs to be revisited. As I said earlier in the hour, I think the only state that does not disenfranchise people who are convicted of a felony is the state of Maine.
Right. I mean, getting back to what you were just saying a few minutes ago, I mean, obviously, let's get honest, you know, nobody likes an offender. But I would think that would make them more dangerous if they didn't have a place to live and they didn't have a job to, you know, to support themselves.
Well, I don't know if I would go so far as to say it makes them more dangerous, but I do think that...
Well, how can you account for where they're at if they don't have a place to live, they don't have a job?
Let me finish my point. My point was, is I do think that it perpetuates crime. There's a difference between being dangerous and being a criminal in many cases. So if you don't have a place to live, if you don't have a means to survive, then it's going to bring you back to the life of crime because you have no other choice. Doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a dangerous crime.
Well, right, but I'm saying that would make that person, you know, it would make them dangerous. It would make them unpredictable.
Potentially.
But you know what would work? If you could call back after 10 o'clock, and because we only have a short time with Molly Kelly, but if you could call back after 10 o'clock, we'll talk about this for as long as you want. Would that be good, caller?
No, that's fine. I just wanted to get that out there, and I'm sorry that I interrupted.
Oh, that's
there.
Okay.
No, that's
all right. But feel free to call back after 10.
Right. I appreciate your point.
Good morning. You're on TalkBack.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Molly Kelly, I'm glad you're here talking about helping people suffering that depend on government. And the way government responds, though, in hard times is by cutting spending and raising taxes. It's the old adage of do less with more. And, you know, you're talking about gambling as a potential solution, but your solution is really using the monopoly power of the state to grant privilege to one or two people, and I wonder who's going to get that. It'll be people, of course, that are connected with the politicians, so you'll be artificially restricting a certain activity to a few places, granting them an artificial monopoly. And, you know, government is just another example of using government to help their friends and punish their enemies. And, you know, you're talking about the harm that people are suffering because they're not getting the services that have been promised by the government to them. But now that, you know, hard times are here, well, it's kind of too bad for a lot of them. But I wonder, what about the harm that you're not talking about? What about the harm that's caused by the government taking all of this money from people in the first place, who could probably figure out better things to do to spend it in ways that benefit them than having it go to this unaccountable gang who takes it, does whatever they want with it, wastes it, you know, and just is not accountable doesn't even answer to the people. So what about those people who are harmed by taking the money in the first place?
You know, I think your question really is a bigger question, and that is, what is the purpose of government? And you and I could probably have a very long discussion about this, and I encourage those discussions. People who know me know that I like to have those discussions. But I have to say, and that's all I can tell you, is what I think the purpose of government is. And I think the purpose of government is to provide the tools and the resources so that individuals can take care of themselves, each other, their families, and their communities. And I feel it is my responsibility as a senator to continue to look at what those tools and resources are and make sure they are available so that we can empower the people who live in our communities to be able to take care of their own families and their communities. And so, you know, these are big questions, these are big discussions, and probably kind of a premise of where we might start in problem solving. And that's where I start.
357-1290. Good morning. You're on TalkBack.
Good morning, Maj.
Good morning.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question for Molly Kelly. Why is any of the concern of the state about getting into the gambling business or restricting it? Why doesn't the state just go back to the Constitution and just let people live as they see fit? That's all I have to ask.
Right. I'm not quite sure how I respond to that, except to say what I feel like I have been saying is that I do think the purpose of government and what we are trying to do and to solve problems is to make sure there is a quality life and that people can live a life with dignity and respect. And government isn't there to take care of people. Government is there to empower people to be able to take care of themselves.
Good morning. You're on TalkBack.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Congratulations on Leah, that's wonderful.
Thank you.
Leah Georgina Morris. I've got a few questions for Mr. Van Wickler. How are you this morning, Mr. Van Wickler?
Well, I'm exhausted, but I'm having a good time. Thank you, sir.
Okay. All right. Well, you'll probably be real exhausted after I get these questions.
He was in the military, so he's not used to getting up early.
I was, too. Excellent. Excellent. What branch were you in?
Army.
Army, okay.
Yes.
I thought so. I hear you're a reborn Christian. Is that true?
Yeah.
Okay.
That happened back in 1981. I'm not a church-going Christian right now, but yeah.
Okay, well, it doesn't necessarily matter. I'm just curious. I consider myself a Christian as well. How do you feel about so many people? I know you say you're delighted, and it's probably a sign of relief that you don't have to hear all the dissenting voices about the jail, but people I don't think are through. I believe people are withholding portions of their taxes for the jail, and I'm curious, basically how you feel about that.
Well, you know, I had my unit went to Iraq, and I wasn't in favor of that. I've got an employee in Afghanistan. I'm not in favor of that. But I know that being a soldier on the battlefield, one of the last things I would want to happen is my government, who put me in a situation like that, would be to withhold resources for me to do the mission that they put me there to do.
And this interesting, I think a better resolution for that would be just to bring them home, but, rather than continue.
I'm responding to your question. The question is, how do I feel about withholding taxes for
something
that...
How do they know how much to withhold?
That's another good question.
Caller, how do they know how much to how much do the people that are withholding know? How do they know how much to withhold?
Well, I had my tax guy do all. Oh, I'm sorry, my tax woman do all my. She audited. She figured out what percentage it was, and she removed that from the bill, and the check's in the mail. So it'll be interesting to see how that works out.
Well, good
luck. Going to deliver.
Okay, now you know that if you go 3 years.
You know what? I know that there are so many people doing this that the county will collapse before, and I sure hope they do.
Because it doesn't get withheld from the county.
I give up my fortune, my life, my property to see this jail close.
Well,
so you,
and I'm not alone.
So
but
you don't
I'm
think,
more than more than.
But
not
the
alone.
Money you
Everyone
withhold.
I talk to hates this jail.
But the money you withhold is withheld not just from the county. It's collected by the city, and when the county says we need money, the city has to give it to them.
Well,
so
maybe
it's withheld from everything.
Need to do what they say they're going to do for us and stop this aggression. You say you're delighted, and I hear you talk about beds as lost revenue. These are human beings that are put in cages for not hurting anyone. And you have said yourself that many of the people who are in there don't deserve to be in there. And you also have the power to let people go. And as a Christian, I find that very, very, very sickening. I when it all comes down to it, there's so many people who are not paying their taxes. You know that there are many, many destroyed Christians, and I say destroyed, and that are inside the jail. And you claim to be a Christian, a reborn Christian, which to me is probably as close as they come. It probably means that you've had some challenges in your life, and you've come to the point where you realize that you want to choose Christianity. And to me, all the Christian is to basically see Jesus and follow him. And I don't see how you can possibly paint yourself in that picture at all. How on earth can you possibly do that?
Well, thanks for giving me an opportunity to respond. This is my opinion of everything that you've just said. You are entitled to your own opinions, but you're not entitled to your own facts. I appreciate the opportunity to call in here and try to get some responsible information, and we're going to provide that to you. The jail is here. The reason I use the word delighted is because anybody that knows me, and I've been in this community for 18 years, knows that the very first reason at the top of the list for why this new jail was needed was for the inhumane conditions for the offenders that are out there. Second was for the staff that have to work there. This jail does not meet any of the standards that are required for a Department
of
Corrections.
The current jail, you mean.
Right. And that's why I use the word delighted, because the conditions of confinement now are humane. They are what they are supposed to be. The institution was built utilizing a democratic process. You have the right to do whatever you want to do with your taxes. Good luck with that. But I say again, you're entitled to your own opinions. You're not entitled to your own facts.
One of the things that troubled me was he said that you have the power to release them. Now, if a judge sentences someone to however much time in the House of Corrections, you cannot say, gee, I don't think he ought to be. Open the door and send him on his way.
It's a perfect reason why I said, the difference between opinions and facts.
Right.
Can I order somebody to open the door to physically let somebody go? That's the world that this caller lives in. Okay? But the fact is, I would be remiss in my duties to do that. There's a court order to hold somebody, they're going to be held.
Right.
I have a job to do, and I do it very good, and so does my staff.
Right. So that's... Good morning, you're on TalkBack.
Hey, good morning. I had a question for Superintendent Van Wickler.
Good morning, okay. Sir.
Good morning. I was wondering what your annual salary is for your role as superintendent.
It's around $85,000 a year.
Did you receive an increase when the new jail plan came through, or will you receive an increase?
No and no.
I see. And I understand you're a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, is that correct?
Yes, I am.
Excellent. What are your thoughts about...
We're actually going to talk about that in the next hour.
And could you talk about that? And
yeah.
I'd love to hear your thoughts about for example, the number of prisoners that are being held on... Nonviolent drug crimes and how much that costs us all.
As Cynthia just said, we're going to focus on that in the next hour.
Okay.
Okay, great. I look forward to it. Thank
all righty.
You.
And just so the listeners know, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition is an organization that was started in 2003, I want to say, by four retired police officers who had very admirable careers from very large jurisdictions that now has thousands of law enforcement officers, judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, who believe that the war on drugs is a failed national policy and that immediate reform is needed. And so I became a member in 2007, and we'll be talking about that the next hour. And the Nixon administration used drugs as the opportunity to start this campaign. So to create a drug-free society is what they set out to do. Well, LEAP supposes, or not supposes, but suggests that it's been 40 years. It's been well over $1 trillion. And drugs are just as available, if not more so today than they were back then. They're in greater supply, more potent than ever before. So the question is, maybe this war is not going to end. And now we're at a time period when our tax resources are so important. And how many nonviolent people are we putting into jail? We talked about Senate Bill 500. We talked about justice reinvestment. And one of the things that they're looking at is how many people are going into jail for nonviolent crimes that is costing us $69 billion a year to sustain. The war on drugs, by the way, was an excellent phrase, because when the Nixon administration called it the war on drugs, at the time, we like to call ourselves a patriotic nation, patriotic society, and we don't surrender a war. If we enter into a war, it's sustained operations until victory. So in that sense, it was a very genius title. And if you weren't for the war, then you were unpatriotic. Right. And our government capitalized on that for many, many years. And so we started this crime control model. We incarcerated a lot of people. We've got all these people in jail. And LEAP says Law Enforcement Against Prohibition feels that, the mission of creating a drug-free society is not possible. We've got 114 million Americans in the United States that have admitted to using an illegal drug at some point in their lifetime. 34 million have admitted to using an illegal drug in the last 12 months. 34 million. You have 2.7 million people behind bars right now. So if you want to apply the crime control model and say we're going to arrest our way out of it, it's not going to happen. So that's a very important thing, to acknowledge. And LEAP believes that our national policy on drug use should not be create a drug-free society. It should be reduce crime, reduce death, reduce disease, and reduce addiction. That those would be responsible reforms, and goals for our policy. We also don't think that it should be a police officer who is in charge of the Office of National Drug Control Policy or our drug czar. We think it should be a doctor, mm-hmm. somebody who understands use, abuse, and addiction. And what we've done is we take these three categories of use, abuse, and addiction. And I say again, if you put it on par with alcohol, okay, there are people that use alcohol, they abuse it. And then there are people that are addicted to it. And certainly the people that are addicted to it lose their family, lose their house, lose their job. They're addicts in a different way. Right. But certainly alcohol is a very dangerous thing. That being said, drugs are a very dangerous thing. And I'm here to tell you, having testified before the House, having testified before the Senate, having been a law enforcement officer for 23 years, who's a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, I'm here to tell you that advocacy for drug policy reform is not advocacy for use.
But people don't understand
People that. Don't understand yeah. it because, as one of your previous callers said, there's too much ignorance out there. People are ignorant. And he also said it's important about being smart, about being educated, about opening books and reading and understanding all of the data that Law Enforcement Against Prohibition uses in its to justify its position are from government sources. And when you start looking at these studies, this meta-analysis, and it becomes data-based policy and decisions are made based on science, rather than fiction, things seem to make a lot more sense. So why can't we legalize, control, and regulate all drugs, is the position of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, And that's going to do a lot of things, a lot of good things. The first of all, I mean, imagine back during alcohol prohibition when Al Capone was in charge of alcohol. He'd be cooking the stuff up in whatever vats that he could cook it up, and people would be working for him. There was no, you had no idea, there was no warning label on it. It didn't tell you the content, didn't tell you how potent it was. People drank it, people got sick, people died. And if you tried to cut in on his market, he'd kill you. Well, does all this sound familiar? This is exactly what's going on with drugs.
And we're back again. I'm Cynthia Georgina.
And I'm Rick Van Wickler.
And we're going to talk about LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition.
Yes.
I got it. Okay. And so tell me about it, Rick. Tell me, what is the difference between, I know, well, let's talk about medical marijuana, decriminalization, and legalization.
Yeah, those are the three different distinctions that most often appear in different legislation, and a lot of people really don't understand it. The other thing a lot of people don't understand is that as a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, I am not in favor of just a medicinal marijuana bill, and I am not in favor of decriminalization. And the reasons why. I do believe that marijuana has a medicinal effect. I think it is good for patients who have used it. And I think it's remarkable in that way. The problem is, if we just pass a medicinal marijuana bill, you have a very small number of people who are authorized to use that substance, number one. Number two, you increase a great deal of observation over the physicians who prescribe it. Mm-hmm. They may not want to prescribe it because it's bringing down new federal mandates, and they're under the microscope for who are they giving it to and why. And the third most important reason is that it's just a fraction of the number of people that use it. There are a lot of people. Estimates are that there are 13 million illegal drug users on any given day. And if you were to just legalize marijuana, you would take your problem from 13 million down to 3 million. So you've got 10 million people doing it. So if you were give all of your legislative attention to just the people who need it medicinally, you're still going to have right. hundreds of thousands of people that are seeking it out and wanting to use it. Now, speaking of seeking it out and wanting to use it, let's go to a decriminalization bill. So you offer a decriminalization pill that says, okay, if you can have up to a quarter ounce or whatever the legislation is, wherever you live, and you won't go to jail. Okay, we're gonna take it from you, you're going to pay a fine, and then we're going to put you into rehab. And I say again, you have the three categories, users, abusers, and addicts. And just because you have less than a quarter of an ounce doesn't make you an addict. There's no evidence that says you can be addicted to marijuana is another issue. But you're avoiding jail time, so that appeases a lot of people. I say again, the problem is you still have all of these people, up to 34 million, who admit to using illegal drugs. 13 million that are probably participating at any given time. And so they would have to purchase that substance from an illegal drug dealer. Now, here's the difference between me, my colleagues in LEAP, and everybody else who is not on board with LEAP. Our plan puts an illegal drug dealer out of business. That's what we want to do. If you have prohibition, you create a market for illegal right. drug dealers. Okay, there's a profit motive here. And when police go out and police arrest a burglar, if they arrest a rapist or something like that, and they put that particular offender in jail, those burglaries stop, those rapes stop. If you put a drug dealer in jail, you create a job opportunity. Somebody else will step right into that market and make a very lucrative living. Finally, with respect to control and regulation, is we have, you know, unfortunately, there are towns and cities and small places even like Keene, Winchester, Hinsdale, where you have a 13 or 14-year-old girl who wants to experiment with drugs because it might be part of the natural order of the universe of things. Right. Regardless of her background, education, socioeconomic status, she's going to experiment. And under prohibition, under the way that we have it today, that young girl, nobody is going to ask her for ID. Nobody is going to be concerned about what she's getting. She's going to have no idea when she purchases that hit of heroin, that bag of heroin, what it's cut with, what's in it, what sort of adulterants are in there. And she can do it, and she can die because it's unregulated. Now, students that take surveys across the country will tell you it's much easier to get illegal drugs than it is to get cigarettes or alcohol. And you know that should be an indication right there.
Exactly.
Okay, that if you have legalization, control, and regulation. Now, does that mean that somebody who's underage cannot get a pint of vodka? Well, you can get a pint of vodka. If you try hard enough, I'm sure that you can.
Right.
But what you know is that it was manufactured in controlled conditions. Can you die from it? Yes, you can. But that's part of our society. It's part of our culture. And drug use is part of our culture, and it's not going to go away. And I think that's what we have to do, is we have to wake up and say, you know, putting everybody in jail who uses an illegal substance is not going to create a drug-free society. That's just ridiculous. And having this economic stimulus package, you know, by way of the DEA and law enforcement, and, you know, we're always getting elected because we get tough on crime, and we consider being tough on crime getting tough on drug dealers. We've been promised for four decades that we're going to put drug dealers out of business and stop this problem.
And it's not happening.
We've not done it. And I don't care who you are. I don't care what your political affiliation is. I don't care what your religion is. I don't care where you come from. There is not a single person who can look me in the eye and say, I honestly believe that we're winning this war on drugs, and pretty soon we're going to have a drug-free society. Nobody will even make believe that that can happen.
Do you think that if it was, if drugs were legalized, that it would stop a lot of the back and forth across the border, for instance?
Of course it will.
Back and forth across
the border. Of course it will. 75%, this is from the DEA. 3.5 months ago, the DEA released a report that said 70% of the gang violence in the United States is due to illegal drug marketplace disputes. They're fighting over the retail sales territory. The number one cash crop today in California is marijuana. Mm-hmm. Number two is grapes, if anybody cares, right?
Right.
It's wine country.
Right.
Right? They make wine there. Number one cash crop is marijuana. And we have an insatiable appetite for these drugs. This country does. And we need to understand that. Now, we have a choice. We can let illegal people make $500 billion a year, money that's untaxed, unregulated, money that comes out of our economy and
right.
goes other places. Or we could legalize it, control it, and regulate it, label it. You can decide how your state wants to distribute it. You know, if you sit in Washington, D.C., within 10 miles, there's four different jurisdictions that govern alcohol distribution four different ways. But it's controlled and it's regulated and it's taxed. And speaking of taxes, Professor Jeff Myron of Harvard, he's an economist,
mm-hmm.
and he did a detailed paper on the impact of legalization. And he estimated that the United States would save, in the first year, they'd save $44.1 billion per year in government expenditures on enforcement of prohibition. And then he said that $32.7 billion would be raised in revenue through taxation.
Wow.
That's a one-year scenario from a Harvard economy professor. All right, there's a lot of folks out there that say, you know what, maybe for marijuana, definitely not for cocaine, definitely not for heroin and all the others. And I can understand that because I went through that process as my mind evolved around this issue, and I tried to educate myself. So I can understand that's a little bit of a difficult thing to do. But remember, if it's illegal, then it's in the hands of an illegal market.
Right.
And people will give money to that illegal market, and we have to remove that profit motive. And you have no drug control policy if it's illegal. If it's illegal, it's out of control. It's not being controlled. But let's just say that we legalize marijuana. And nothing else. If we just legalized marijuana, I submit this question. Why is marijuana illegal in the first place? Why is it illegal? Is it harmful? When you compare marijuana to alcohol, does marijuana kill more people than alcohol? I have here annual causes of death in the United States, this printout. Let me run through a couple of these for you. Tobacco kills 435,000 people a year. Cigarettes do. Poor diet and physical inactivity kills 365,000 people. Alcohol is directly related to 85,000 deaths a year. Let's go down and skip a couple of these. How about motor vehicle crashes? 26,000 people a year. Suicides, 30,000. Homicide, 20,000. Sexual behaviors, 20,000 deaths a year. How about anti-inflammatory drugs like aspirin are responsible for 7,600 deaths a year? Marijuana, zero.
That's
zero.
I mean, do you, if people hear that, how many of them are going to believe it?
Well, you know, you're entitled to your own opinions.
Right, exactly.
You're not entitled to your own facts. Okay, these are the facts. And I understand being in law enforcement, when you start talking about this issue, your initial response is to dig in deep and not hear this. But you have to evolve intellectually. You have to read about this. There's a book out there that's called Sense and Nonsense About Crime and Drugs. It's by Samuel Walker. It's actually a textbook from the Wadsworth Contemporary Company. And they collect all of these studies that have been done by the government, the Bureau of Justice Statistics, and all these other people, and, you know, collate it and put it into this little book that separates the difference between fact and fiction about crime and drugs. And the more you learn about this drug war, the more you learn about the problem, the easier it is to say, man, are we doing the wrong thing, and we need a major shift in paradigm very quickly.
Now, do you see with coming, like, drugs, not marijuana necessarily, but harder drugs, coming in strength, sort of like alcohol comes in different proofs? I don't understand how this is going. I mean,
well,
just to get an idea how this is going to work or would work.
I'm certainly not an expert on drug use because I don't use them.
We're great.
I am simply, and I say again, that advocacy for drug policy reform is not advocacy for use. I am just, you know, as a taxpayer, a responsible citizen, and a law enforcement officer, suggesting that we need to take another look at this. In answer to your question, I do think that if it is manufactured by the government, it is controlled, it is labeled, at least when that 14-year-old girl gets a hold of something she's not going to have to, not supposed to have access to, and she sits down under a legalized scenario and she mainlines that into her veins, she could survive. Versus buying it from an illegal drug dealer on the streets, and you don't know what's in there or what the potency is, she's going to die, and she's going to get addicted. It's bad. Drugs are bad, and they should be left alone. And as far as the relationship between drugs and crime, you know, if everybody does drugs, then everybody will cause crime. There's, you know, the evidence to support that is very ambiguous and not clear. We at LEAP say, sure, drugs cause crime like a fork causes obesity.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Okay?
And you can have, I'm thinking that you, just as you have alcohol, you'd have to still continue to have drug rehab places. But perhaps people would be more willing to go into them to get cured, if you will, or rehabbed, or whatever if you want to call it, than they would if they're doing something illegal. Not only do you have to go in there and admit that I have a problem, but you have to admit that I have an illegal problem.
You bring up a really good point. And let me read you this statistic. Addiction affects 22 million Americans today. Addiction, okay? And it doesn't say here specifically what to, but I think it's going to categorize anybody as an addict. 75% of addicts are in the workforce. 75%.
Wow.
And only 9% of Americans who need treatment receive it because of the very reason that you just cited.
Right.
And there was a story of a school principal who had a 20-year heroin habit not too long ago. 20-year heroin habit. She was the principal of a school. And these are that's the real America. Those are the real things that are going on. So the only thing that we, in layman's terms, in society, is we see the addicts. We see the worst of it.
Right.
We see the worst of what is going on, and we blanket policy that over, well, that must be how everybody is. And it's not true. We know that people that try marijuana in high school and college, and again, this is another government statistic, that the prevalence for lifetime use is 15%. So if you tried it in high school, you tried it in college, and now you're 60 years old, and you know you're still rolling joints and doing water pipe hits or whatever you do, there's 15% of the people that still do that. With respect to heroin, it's 1.5%.
Right.
It's very, very low. So people either get into it, they die, or they get out of it. But one thing's for sure, once you've tried heroin, according to these statistics, it's not going to be a lifetime prevalent thing. The other thing is, if we legalize drugs, everybody will be doing it. And there was a Zogby poll out that did extensive reviews on that, and 99% of the people said that if, you know, drugs were legalized today, it wouldn't necessarily change what they did tomorrow. It might spike a little bit. It might increase a little bit for marijuana. You know, there are probably some people that are wondering, what's all this hype about? And they try it, but social scientists say that if you don't like it today, you're probably not going to like it then.
Right.
You know,
right.
You either have a propensity to do it or you don't have a propensity to do it.
Has anyone ever done a study on how much, ideally it would be controlled by states, but how much overall we could make on bringing in taxes from all of these these?
Yeah. Things? Well, when you look at Jeff Myron's report, he said $32.7 billion.
Right. You did say that.
$32.7 billion. Can you imagine that, Cynthia?
That.
In the first year, and that's money that we're not getting. $500 billion is an unimaginable amount of money, and so again, if you're not in favor of legalization and control and regulation, that means that you're in favor of the prohibition type era that allows outlaws to have this
right,
money
right.
That allows unregulated substance.
357-1290. Good morning. You're on TalkBack.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have never heard one police chief's association or the state police union, I've never heard them come out publicly and back to stand of yours. So is it just a minority of police officers that believe this, or do you think that you're in the majority with your feelings?
We're in what I guess I would call the silent majority. There was a survey done a couple of years ago. 67% of the police chiefs that were polled felt that the war on drugs was a failure and in need of immediate reform. But they also said that they would not publicly say that for fear of retribution for their position and their jobs. And I think that's also true for a lot of law enforcement officers. You know, in 1920, in 1933, with alcohol prohibition, you had a generation of people where alcohol was legal, and then the government said, okay, this is illegal. And then 13 years later, they said, we tried this, it didn't work. We're going to go back to legalization, right. And the states repealed it with the 18th Amendment. So, well, let me finish my point, sir, before I forget it, because I easily forget things. And what you have with the drug war era, whereas it started in the late 60s and the early 70s until now, you have politicians, you have police officers, police chiefs that have been born into prohibition. They don't know anything but prohibition. And just like when you're in the Army and you go through the police academy and you become a police officer, you are programmed with what you are supposed to do, and you do it for your career. And if you do it the way that your superiors want you to do it, you will progress and you will excel. And that's our system. So now we've got a system of prohibition that generations have been born into, very, very difficult to get out of.
I believe that when they were going to decriminalize marijuana, that the police chiefs in New Hampshire took a stand against this. They went and spoke against the bill.
Yeah, there are police chiefs who speak against the bill, and I was over there at the State House when they were doing that, and I'm not here to advocate for them about why they took the position that they did. I just think that this is an enormous problem that you cannot arrest your way out of. And it is at what we're doing now is at significant expense to the taxpayer, and it needs reform.
I understand that, but I just think I got grandkids, I got kids of my own, and I just think the wrong thing is to make it available over the counter so they can walk into a store, drugstore or something, and just pick it up and try it.
Well, it would be regulated, I would think, much like alcohol. You couldn't buy it until you were a certain age.
Here's the thing. We can't fool ourselves as parents and grandparents to think that it's not available today.
Right.
It is readily available. And the problem is, under prohibition, it is more readily available to your children than if it were legalized, controlled, and regulated. That's the issue. And you're not saying, by legalizing it, that we want you to do it, any more than you're saying, you see this scotch that I'm drinking tonight, Johnny? Well, I don't want you to do it. Okay? It's the same kind of thing.
If you can buy it, then it makes it a hell of a lot easier than going downtown and asking some of the dealers down there.
Yeah, but the problem is,
where can I go? You got to run to Manchester, go to Concord.
No, you don't. No, you don't.
Well,
I don't know where you live, sir. Do you live in Keene?
No, I live right outside of Keene.
Okay. Well, I'm sure that I could go in your neighborhood with people who know the area and score something rather quickly.
I don't think so.
I think I can.
Well, that's good. But I just think you're wrong. And
okay. I appreciate your opinion and your criticism, and welcome
thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Rick, thank you very, very much for being here, and good luck with the opening of the jail, which should be happening before too long.
Yes, as I said, it's not a celebration, it's an acknowledgement.
That's our show for today, folks. Thanks to our producer, Forrest Sundstrom, and thanks to all of you for letting us be part of your Saturday morning. I'm not going to be here for the next couple of weeks, but tune in next Saturday morning when Guy McMillan, former editor of the Keene Sentinel, will be sitting in for us. And the following Saturday when our old friend Fred Parcells will be here. I'll be on vacation, and I'm going to have a great time. I hope you do, too.